It will not take responsibility for a headline that says Parnell took years to act when in fact I acted on every allegation.
Governor Parnell defends his record on National Guard misconduct. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a man in prison for the Fairbanks 4 murder has been paroled.
They don't want to walk out of prison as, you know, convicted murderers on parole. They want to walk out of prison as exonerated men.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Last month, Governor Sean Parnell released a brutal federal report on misconduct in the Alaska National Guard. Sexual assault reports were mishandled and alleged perpetrators were promoted. Military aircraft were used for personal reasons. Two state officials have already resigned as a result of the abuses. Now the governor is playing defense too. With only a month left before Election Day, Governor Parnell is rejecting claims that he did not respond to the problems quickly enough. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
At 9:15 a.m., Governor Sean Parnell announced he was holding a press conference to take questions about the Alaska National Guard alongside Brigadier General John Mott, who had come in from Connecticut to help him with the reform effort. Less than 2 hours later, Parnell stood at the podium alone, and with First Lady Sandy Parnell in the audience instead. He explained the catalyst for the appearance was a headline in Thursday's Alaska Dispatch News.
Parnell took years to act on National Guard misconduct. I believe that statement was false, and it was misleading.
Parnell directed his remarks to Guard members, even though none were in the room and the Brigadier General wasn't there because of federal rules preventing him from holding press conferences. Parnell asked Guardsmen to question news coverage that is critical of his response to their concerns, and reiterated that he checked in with recently ousted Adjutant General Thomas Katkus after each complaint his office received.
Every time I heard an allegation, every time I got an allegation of misconduct, or my office did, we investigated that with Guard leadership.
For the next 30 minutes, Parnell mostly played defense. He offered that there will be further leadership changes within the National Guard, but he would only say he knew of 3 instances of this and wouldn't name names. Parnell also told reporters that he did not anticipate any changes to his own staff.
To my knowledge, everybody in my office acted in good faith. They acted reasonably. They did it timely. And I have nothing to the contrary at this point, and I do have complete faith and confidence in my staff.
Parnell called for an investigation into the force this spring, but National Guard chaplains first approached his office with concerns in 2010. He says the reason for the lag time was that he trusted Katkus that the appropriate processes were being followed.
I think I was misled on a number of occasions about how well the system was working. There's no question I was. I mean, the report demonstrates that.
When asked by reporters why he trusted the very leadership that was the subject of complaints, Parnell says there are some things he wishes he could have done differently, but he takes umbrage at news coverage that suggests he did not do enough.
I took full responsibility, and I take full responsibility for not discovering what I discovered in February and it taking that length of time to get there. But I will not take responsibility for a headline that says Parnell took years to act when in fact I acted on every allegation.
Shortly after Parnell cut the press conference short to catch a flight, a group of about a dozen protesters gathered outside his Anchorage office.
Sean Parnell has got to go.
They were with Alaska Woman for Political Action, and they waved signs that said stop the violence and hold Parnell accountable. Barbara McDaniel is with the Alaska chapter of the National Organization of Women, and she doesn't think Parnell's response went far enough. She believes Parnell has not released enough information on how his office handled National Guard complaints. She says the administration's stance seems to be, trust us.
When someone says that to you, you need to watch out.
McDaniel says she's disappointed that the governor has turned down multiple records requests into how his office responded to complaints made about the Guard, including a request that was made by APRN. She'd like to see some of those documents come out before the November election, but she doesn't believe that will happen.
Well, if I was running for office, I would definitely want to slow it down and have everything come out after I'd possibly won.
Parnell and his staff have listed privacy of victims as a reason for outright rejecting requests into office email and not releasing even redacted information. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A Fairbanks man imprisoned for murder has been granted parole. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Alaska Parole Board approved Eugene Vent's request despite continued claims by him and other members of the so-called Fairbanks Four that they are innocent.
Eugene Vent, who's serving 38 years for the 1997 beating death of John Hartman, is scheduled to be paroled sometime in 2017. Vent will follow Marvin Roberts, who's serving a 33-year sentence for the Hartman killing and scheduled to be paroled next May. Fairbanks 4 advocate April Monroe Frick says the paroles are significant.
Paroling Marvin and agreeing to a parole release date for Eugene is the first time that we're aware of that anybody has been paroled while still maintaining their innocence.
Alaska Parole Board Director Jeff Edwards says board hearings are not open to the public and would not comment. John Hartman's brother, Chris Kelly, says he and his family believe the Fairbanks 4 are guilty and opposes their parole. Monroe Frick says parole conditions for Vent and Roberts have not been set.
They could remain in some form of custody, halfway houses, things like that. And whether they're inside prison or outside prison, exoneration is critically important to all of them. They don't want to walk out of prison as, you know, convicted murderers on parole. They want to walk out of prison as exonerated men.
The other two members of the Fairbanks Four, George Fries and Kevin Pease, are serving much longer sentences for their roles in the Hartman murder and are not eligible for parole. Applications for post-conviction relief filed on behalf of all four in September of last year center on the confession of a former local serving time for an unrelated murder. William Holmes claims a group of friends, not the Fairbanks Four, killed Hartman in a random attack. Holmes pins the most deadly blows on Jason Wallace, who's also jailed for an unrelated murder. The state calls Holmes' statements hearsay, but has scheduled an evidentiary hearing for November 10th in Fairbanks. Central to the case are earlier statements about the Hartman murder made by Wallace to his lawyer. Statements state attorney Adrian Bachman says are sealed.
Those communications are privileged, which means confidential, which means not disclosable.
Bachman says the proceedings regarding Wallace's statements will be necessarily closed to the public. Monroe Frick says it's morally wrong that Wallace's statements about the Hartman murder remain sealed. She says Fairbanks 4 supporters plan to pack the courtroom at next month's hearing, even if they are immediately ushered out. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Four people were safely evacuated from a drilling platform in Cook Inlet that caught fire this morning. The Coast Guard says the fire appeared to be out by 1 p.m., but has since flared up again. The fire on the Baker platform, located about 8 miles offshore of Nikiski and owned by Hillcorp, was reported shortly after 8 a.m. Hillcorp spokeswoman Lori Nelson says the platform was in production mode, but shut down quickly.
The Baker platform had solely gas production, and it was only from one well, which was shut in as well as any access to the pipeline system. There will be both an internal and external investigation once the fire's out and that's been determined safe for folks to be on board that platform again.
The platform holds 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel, but none of it had spilled, according to the Unified Command that was established to respond to the incident. Aerial photos show the living quarters of the platform fully engulfed in flames earlier today. The four personnel working the platform were evacuated by helicopter. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Quinnahock residents are hopeful hair samples from a nearby archaeological site will unlock mysteries about their ancestors.
We might get to see who was related to the people of Aralik. That's pretty cool.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here.
Native leaders say a September 12th Alaska Supreme Court ruling in a case involving a Yupik child will cause higher numbers of Native children to be cut off from their families and culture. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, the state says the decision in Tununik versus the state of Alaska will put kids into permanent homes more quickly and follows a U.S. Supreme Court ruling.
Baby Dawn, not her real name, was 4 months old in 2008 when the state took custody of her. She was put in foster care with a non-Native family in Anchorage. Baby Dawn is Yupik, so the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, applies. ICWA was enacted to reduce the high number of Native children being placed in non-Native homes. It gives preference to Native families in custody cases. But after the mother's parental rights were terminated, the foster parents' petition for adoption of baby Dawn was approved in 2012. The baby's grandmother had testified she wanted custody, but didn't file an adoption petition, which would have required the help of an attorney. Alaska Assistant Attorney General Jacqueline Schaefer says the case revolved around the way the grandmother asked to adopt.
The question in this adoption appeal then became, did the grandmother formally seek to adopt the child, even though she didn't file an adoption petition or intervene in the adoption case or attend the adoption hearing? But she did testify at the placement hearing in the related child in need of aid case that she wanted custody.
Schaefer says the Alaska Supreme Court was bound by a 2013 U.S. Supreme Court ruling against granting custody of baby Veronica to her Cherokee father. He had mistakenly terminated his parental rights and was seeking to have that overturned. The ruling against him was decided in part because he had not filed a petition to adopt his biological daughter. The baby Veronica case was decided by a 5-4 U.S. Supreme Court decision. One of the dissenting justices said the ruling violated ICWA's text and purpose. Alaska Federation of Natives co-chair Anna Hoffman of Bethel says the Alaska court ruling that removes baby Dawn from her Native family and community also contradicts ICWA.
The Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted to prevent that exact thing from happening. It was to ensure the unification of Native families and Native children, and to allow for Native families to provide the nurturing homes for the Native children that are in care.
Schaefer says the requirement to file an adoption petition means everybody interested in adopting a child will lay their cards on the table at a placement hearing rather than at an adoption hearing that would come later in the process. That, she says, will put children into permanent homes more quickly.
When the child has a permanent placement option that wants to adopt, what the U.S. Supreme Court seems to be saying is that it's not good enough to have people come forward that far along into the case and say, you know, sure, I'd be interested in having custody and, you know, seeing where this goes, and I'm interested. That isn't enough when you already have a formal adoption petition on the table and that child could achieve permanency. The U.S. Supreme Court is saying we need to see a formal request to adopt.
Hoffman says the court has added a costly step to an already complicated process. Schaefer says the court directed the court system, tribes, agencies, and attorneys to work to simplify the process of filing an adoption petition.
After this decision, the court really emphasized that there needs to be some more rules that to make it easier for people to file for adoption.
Hoffman says as it is now, various families can be considered for placement, but she says the added expense and complications of getting legal assistance and initiating an adoption case will be insurmountable hurdles for some families. As a result, she says there will be fewer options for finding the best placement for a child, and more children will be leaving their home communities, she says, with serious consequences.
What it would mean for these communities is loss of access, continuation of culture, a loss of the sense of community that should be there.
Attorneys for the Native village of Tununuk may ask the court to reconsider its decision. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
An archaeological dig near Quinnahock in southwest Alaska contributed the largest set of genetic samples for a groundbreaking DNA study of Arctic indigenous people released this summer. The study answers long-standing questions about migrations of ancient Alaska Native people on the state's west coast, and as KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports, local people hope to learn even more about their own ancestors.
The project, called Nunahlik, meaning Old Village, is located 5 miles outside Quinnahock. Dr. Rick Connect is an archaeologist with the University of Aberdeen in Scotland who manages the dig. He says permafrost at the ancient Yupik village of Akralik preserved artifacts up to 700 years old made of wood and leather that normally would have disintegrated. Connect says that most sites in the lower 48 provide just stones and bones, but at the Akralik site they get
things like utensils people used in their daily lives. We get bentwood bowls and scoops. We get ulus with the handles still on them. We get grass baskets, for example, complete grass baskets and woven mats. We're getting things like weapons and kayak parts, masks and artwork, things that you normally just see in museums. And these all date from between about 1400 and 1600 AD.
And hundreds of hair samples, Connect says, likely clippings from haircuts, were also preserved at the site. Some of those clippings contributed to the study of indigenous Alaskans that was featured in the journal Science this summer.
We contributed about 33 hair samples to the study. And I think that's more than any of the sites were able to produce, and just because of the extraordinary preservation here.
There were 169 samples analyzed in the study. The study, led by a group of Danish researchers, revealed that the modern Inuit people, including those in Alaska, are descended from the Thule, who developed around 700 years ago, replacing an earlier population, the Paleo-Eskimos. The genetic evidence shows there was very little interbreeding and that the Thule are the ancestors of the Yupik and Inupiat people living on Alaska's west coast today.
We don't know, the origins of that, what we call the Thule population or the Neo-Eskimos. But we do know that both in the archaeological evidence, both the artifacts and the genetics look very much alike, surprisingly so, on the two ends of the Arctic, which is the largest indigenous territory of any group in the world.
Connect says the donation of the hair clippings from the Akralik site was the sole contribution for the study from Alaska. Warren Jones is the president of the village corporation in Quinnahock, Connectuk Incorporated. He says they agreed to work with the archaeologists because they want to learn more about the people who they believe may be their ancestors.
The archaeologists know what they're doing, and everything they dig out is going to be brought back to us. So it'll be here for our future children, generations. I mean, now our future kids, grandkids, they'll be able to see what our ancestors lived, how they lived, what they used, the tools they make. All the little stories are coming alive.
Jones says the corporation is interested in comparing the DNA of the ancient people of Akralik with the modern residents of Quinnahock.
We might get to see who was related to the people of Akralik. So that's pretty cool.
Jones says the corporation in Quinnahock eventually wants to develop ecotourism around the archaeological site, but rapid erosion at the site has made getting artifacts out a priority. Connect says it requires a certain level of trust for Native people to allow genetic material to be released for studies, and that over the past 5 years of the project, researchers from the University of Aberdeen and Native people in Quinnahock have built that trust. The project is funded by Connectuk Incorporated and through a $1.8 million grant from the UK-based Arts and Humanities Research Council. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, a attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Alaska's congressional candidates were in Kodiak last night for a debate that pitted candidates running for both the House and Senate against their opponents on a number of fisheries-related issues. First to take the stage at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium were the candidates for U.S. Senate. Incumbent Senator Mark Baggage squared off with Republican candidate Dan Sullivan, answering questions from a media panel, audience members, and each other. One topic was Russia's recent ban on seafood imports from the U.S. and its potential impacts on Alaska's seafood industry. When asked how he might handle an international issue like this, Sullivan cited his work with the Bush administration as useful experience.
Part of my responsibilities were working to open markets for American goods throughout the world. So I have deep experience not only working with the State Department, where most of this would take place in terms of how we deal with these kind of issues, but also in terms of dealing with sanctions. And the big problem right now is with Russia, is with sanctions.
Baggage addressed the state's aging commercial fisheries fleet and how to promote better access for the next generation of young fishermen. He said the cost of entering the industry is very expensive and more needs to be done to help with those costs.
Community shares are an opportunity where you can engage maybe at a lower cost, engage that kind of first time, as I like to call it, first time homeowner, you know, first time fisherman, to get their feet wet, literally, and be able to do some fishing and understand the business. But you have to have a certain amount of shares available. This concept that now the council is discussing, I'm very intrigued about.
During the second half of the debates, the candidates for U.S. House took the stage to try their hand at fisheries issues. Incumbent Republican Congressman Don Young was asked whether or not he felt current regulations and environmental cleanup operations in place were sufficient to handle possible environmental damage caused by increased shipping traffic and oil exploration in the Arctic.
They're not sufficient. This is one of our problems. I'm with Mr. Larson from Washington State, a congressman, bipartisan. We're setting up an Arctic commission. We've worked to try to get the Coast Guard established in the Arctic, and I'm trying to get new icebreakers.
Democratic congressional challenger Forrest Dunbar was asked his opinion on seafood labeling, and he was quick to express his support of country of origin labeling and an overall strengthening of all seafood labels.
You know, again, I grew up in Cordova. And our issue, when I was first going out fishing, farm fish was flooding the market, and the price had crashed. And people weren't able to distinguish, and they still have trouble distinguishing between farm salmon from Norway or Canada or from fresh Alaskan salmon. That's wrong. They have an inferior product. We have a superior product, and it should be labeled as such.
All 4 candidates will be on the November 4th general election ballot. A new fitness center, which includes a swimming pool, is set to open in Bethel in November. The project has been in the works for decades, and anticipation is building in the community where no other such facility exists. KYUK's Charles Enoch has the story.
Immediately to the right of the entrance is a food court where healthy snacks will be sold. Straight ahead is the main attraction.
The main question when I got here is there water in the pool? Yes, there is water in the pool. So right now what we're doing is implementing programs and trying to get people inside of the facility.
That's Ronnie Carey, the director of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Regional Aquatic Health and Safety Center, in a town with not much indoor recreation to speak of and where the temperature is below freezing much of the year. The center is an exciting prospect. It's been in the works for decades, and most people don't call it by its big, unwieldy name. They just call it the pool. Actually, there are 2 pools, the biggest one being a regulation-sized pool with 6 lanes separated by blue and white floats. The larger pool can be used for water sports, both competitive and fun. The smaller pool connected to it is more about fun. A yellow tube slide leads into the smaller pool. It has sensors that signal kids when the slide is clear and it's safe to slide. The smaller, more shallow pool has a handicap entry and can also be used for therapy. And beside that, a jacuzzi with state-of-the-art jets for maximum therapy. The pools and jacuzzi are filled with well over 100,000 gallons of water that has to be cleaned. The pool looks like it's constantly overflowing, but it's really draining into small holes just off the edges. Ray explains where the water goes.
This right here takes it into the surge tank, goes through the surge tank, and then refilters throughout the system. Before it goes back into the system, it goes through an ultraviolet light, which kills everything inside of the water. After going through that ultraviolet light, then it's chlorinated and filtered back into the pool.
A state-of-the-art cleaning system, says Ray. Going into the next room, she explains the large machines that are constantly humming.
These right here are sand filtration systems for the main pool. So we have a set of three of them. So that way, at all times, water is continuously circulating. We have backup pumps as well.
All of this seems like it would take a lot of power to run, and it does. But Ray explains a windmill outside provides well over half of the power needed to run the center, while the rest comes from the grid. In the next room is an emergency generator in case of a power outage. There are also rooms for yoga, dance classes, and a workout room. Bev Hoffman of Bethel has been working to make the center a reality for years. She says it's nice to see a longtime dream come true.
I kept thinking that it will become a reality, but for 30 years it was a dream until 2007. The community started to get behind it.
In the early days, Hoffman and other community members held bake sales and other fundraisers. More recently, funding the project was made possible through several grants and donations. Around $23 million came from the state. The Rasmussen Foundation and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Diabetes Prevention Program both contributed funds for workout equipment. Managers say they're still putting the finishing touches on the center, and it's on track for a grand opening in November. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton and Charles Enoch in Bethel, and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.